This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more. The debate.
At the start of the 1960s, the UK embarked on a program of covert action in Latin America. While the work of US intelligence in the region has been widely publicized, the UK role is much less known, but recently declassified files reveal attempts to influence elections and disrupt trade unions in a number of Latin American countries. At the behest of the British Foreign Office and MI6, the decision was taken in London in 1961 to increase covert activities where the role of Britain was kept hidden, with a particular focus on black propaganda, which involves false material and being deliberately misleading about who was producing it. With the British historically known for meddling in countries like Iran, India, Palestine, and so on, what was the actual extent of their interference in Latin America? Well, let's start off this segment with our correspondent, Amina Taylor, who's with us from the British capital, London. Amina, why hasn't this story been covered by mainstream media?
Well, from places from Ecuador, Cuba, Chile, when you have statements where there's a little gold star attached to Venezuela, where it says, "Ooh, a very rich target, very good because of its resources," it shows where Britain's concerns were. It was about influence, that's extending that sphere of influence, running alongside Americans, essentially picking up any of the diplomatic scraps that were left there, and building its own, but about establishing its own kind of dual power base where it could, if things didn't go well, as if it didn't in some of the cases, you could easily shift the blame to Washington and say, "Well, look at those guys, you know." Britain's been far more sneaky in its endeavors, and I think this recently released cache of documents shows that it's not really a surprise to those who are watching this historically, and goodness knows what the next 50 years or so will bring, because if, touch wood, I'm alive to look at those new documents that will surely be revealed about the extent of British influence in the region now, I think so many of us will realize we've just skimmed the very surface by it.
All right, thanks a lot. That was our London correspondent, Amina Taylor. Let's bring in Mr. Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, who's with us from San Francisco. Mr. Becker, welcome to the program. Why do you think the UK carried out these operations in Latin America?
Well, I think that we must remember that for a century and a half, Britain was the dominant empire in the world. And its empire included, although it was really a prelude to a widespread neocolonialism, the relationship to much of Latin America was a neocolonial relationship, in that it didn't involve widespread conquering of territory. There was British Honduras, now Belize, and British Guyana, now Guyana, and the Falkland Islands, they called them the Malvinas, the Argentinians do. But it was more an economically dominant relationship of extreme exploitation of many countries. Venezuela, the gold mines of Venezuela, and gold and Venezuela have come back into the news this year. The relationship with Argentina, which was really in many ways kind of the breadbasket of England for beef and for wheat and so forth. So there's that long-term relationship. 100 years ago or 120 years ago, half of all of the foreign investment in Latin America was British foreign investment. It's nothing like that now. It's really more like 1% or 2% of the foreign investment. But Britain is looking to restore a much stronger position in Latin America, and particularly as Brexit approaches, and that would be particularly in regard to food imports into England. I think the bottom line is this, is that Britain was once the dominant foreign power in Latin America. It no longer is anything close to that. The British, as your correspondent said, have always been willing to take the scraps off the table as the junior partner of U.S. imperialism, whether it was in Iran or it's in Iraq or in Afghanistan or in Libya. The British government has, since World War II, with lots of contradictions, which I don't want to underestimate in any way, but has been the junior partner of the U.S., a faithful servant. And, back in the early days of the Iraq War, there were the depictions of the British Prime Minister as the lapdog. And that was certainly an appropriate depiction.
Latin America expert Isaac Biggio joins us now, also from the British capital, London. Mr. Biggio, welcome to Press TV's debate. This would appear puzzling to many. The UK at that point was overstretched. Latin America fell outside its area of strategic interest. And UK covert action was, in fact, dwarfed by that of the US. Why the effort then?
Well, you have to understand that the UK was the main power that created Latin America, because the UK supported the independence movements against Spain. 5,000 UK troops supported Simon Bolivar. Then the UK was the dominant foreign power in Latin America for more than one century. It was involved in the war between Chile, Peru, and Bolivia, in the two Paraguayan wars. Defending the unity of Brazil when it has some secession movements in the 1820s. So it has a dominant power, and the pound was the main currency in Latin America until the First World War. So Britain was perhaps the main power until the Second World War. So it lost its hegemony toward the United States, but it always tried to keep some influence. And we saw in this document, the 1960s, the UK tried to overthrow the Cuban government to stop Allende taking power in 64, against an Ecuadorian nationalist government. The UK was working with the United States, albeit the UK never restored its dominant position in Latin America.
Mr. Becker, based on the files declassified in 2019 and 2020, the UK reportedly worked on trade unions through infiltrating and capturing them or disrupting meetings. We can see that the level of interference was widespread. Why was this information not disclosed sooner? Why now?
Well, of course, the governments of the United States and Britain, France, Germany, they all want to keep what they're really doing hidden. They want to be able to pretend, oh, we're the forces for democracy in the world against the forces of evil and all that. And so to expose the fact that they're really intervening in this heinous ways in the people's movements in Latin America and around the world, meaning trade unions in particular, which have a particular importance and particular power, and in governments and political parties. This is, very widespread. But as I say, exposing that to the public view really puts a dent in the idea that these are really democratic countries and that they're interested in upholding democracy. They all were fine with the brutal, murderous, indescribable dictatorships in Latin America that came into being, starting in Brazil in 64, and then, in Chile and Argentina and Uruguay and all over the continent, just about. these really brutal regimes, they were fine with they were supported by Washington and by London and by their other allies. So this, I think, that explains the fact that the mass media, the corporate mass media in both countries, really, when push comes to shove, acts as a voice of the government, acts as another branch of the government, in fact. And it has to be investigative reporting that's done to dig through all the material and find the truth of what's been going on and expose it to the world.
Isaac Biggio, in 1961, London decided to increase the covert activities where the role of Britain was kept hidden, with a particular focus on black propaganda, where people are deliberately misled about who is producing it. Talking about corporate mass media, which Mr. Becker just mentioned right now, the BBC has allegedly been complicit in such actions. That wasn't just in Latin America, was it? We have Iran, we have India, and other countries coming to mind immediately.
Yeah, well, the BBC has never been neutral, no? But why this year is so important, because this is the year in which Cuba decided to become a socialist country. It became close to the Soviet Union. It was the first time that the Soviet Union have an important ally in the Americas. And so the UK and the United States were very much afraid that the Cuban Revolution could be expanded. So they tried to stop government like the one, left-wing governments like the one in Brazil. They tried to combat nationalist movement, to fight against nationalist movements in the continent. And, well, as you know, London has always a policy to defend their own interest in the world, no? In the Middle East, in Africa. London used to be the most important overseas empire in world history. After the Second World War, the UK gradually lost its empire, but it tried to keep some influence with the Commonwealth and working together with the United States with a special relation. In the case of Latin America, a very important issue that united London and Washington was to stop Moscow in Cuba and to stop the spread of the Cuban Revolution.
Sure, Mr. Becker. The operations included creating a new magazine in Colombia, distributing pamphlets in Chile and Bolivia. Local radio producers were bribed to get airtime and produce tapes to be played. Doesn't that bear the hallmarks of the British colonial meddling in the Middle East, the Indian subcontinent, and elsewhere?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it wasn't just Britain, but even on a much greater scale, the United States did the same. There's a very interesting book that came out several years ago called The Cultural Cold War, about there was a vast plan that included tours of dance companies and theater companies and the production of books and pamphlets and movies and videos and everything you can imagine by the U.S. and the British on a smaller scale but still significant scale to try to delude public opinion in different parts of the world in their favor. And, you know, I have to say this, that back in 1895, when the U.S. and Britain almost went to war over Venezuela, and they settled it, but the British got to keep their gold mines, which was their big priority in Venezuela. Now today, in July of this year, the British High Court ruled that the Britain did not have to turn over a billion dollars in gold bullion that's in the Bank of England account to Venezuela, saying that Guaido, Juan Guaido, this imposter, this really, you know, a figure who will be remembered, I think, as a comedy in history, that his government was the legitimate one, even though he hadn't run for president, that he was the legitimate president. And this, again, following in the footsteps of the United States, following and promoting the U.S. policy as well. But there we have 125-year link between of gold in the relationship of England, of Britain, to Latin America. It's the same thing continues in just different forms.
Right, and Mr. Bijo, as you mentioned earlier, this was in the 60s, but when we look at the dispute, for example, with the Malvinas Islands and the war that took place in 1982, the colonial attitude towards Latin America wasn't confined to just one certain period, was it?
Well, the United Kingdom always tried to have ambitions in the Americas. There are several countries in the Americas that accept Elizabeth II as their queen, Belize, Jamaica. There are many Commonwealth countries, Guyana, for example. And Britain tried to create colonies in what is now Argentina, you know, they tried to Buenos Aires, and finally, I think in 1839 in the 1830s, they took what the Argentina called Malvinas and what they called then the Falklands. And in this war, it was very important for Thatcher, as you can see in this film from the royal family, you know, the Crown, that Thatcher used the Malvinas Falkland War to consolidate her power. Without that war, she would have been removed from power because it was quite unpopular. And it was the first and only time that we had a war inside the Antarctic area, because part of the war were in Georgia and the Sandwich Islands. So the UK has always tried to keep their influence in the Americas, albeit now is not so important. And allow me to talk about something about Guaido, because the other person talk about that. We had just in Venezuela on the 12th of December, Guaido organized a referendum. When the Catalans did a referendum, they were not allowed to do that. There were more than 1,000 people arrested, and the European Union supported Spain. When Guaido organized a referendum, that there was no repression on that referendum. Until now, nobody knows what are the results. Everybody could vote. People can vote 3, 4, 5 times. People can vote even forging their documents. There's no international control, and despite all of that, Guaido is being recognized as the president of Venezuela, and the USA said that this is a legitimate election. The one that Trump lost in the United States is not a legitimate election, but this one it is. So this is the kind of democracy which the main powers are promoting. It doesn't matter what is the opinion of the population, it's their interest, and they are supporting Guaido. It's incredible. They are still supporting Guaido and recognizing him as a president. He's a president in America without control of their own country.
That's a very interesting point you brought up there, Richard Becker. I'd like you to comment on that as well. What similarities can be drawn to what is happening today, for example, with Venezuela or Syria, for that matter?
Well, I think that it's very clear that what's happening to Venezuela, there's a true disaster going on in Venezuela, that the cutting off of virtually all trade is a terrible, and it's reminiscent of what was done to Iran back in the early 1950s, when Mossadegh was the elected head of government. And we see this also in Syria. And what do we see in all these countries? We see hungry people, people who don't have medical supplies, because these sanctions, as they're called, amount to international blockades, are imposed, and Britain participates fully in it. The U.S. leads the way, but it's a disaster for the people of all those countries. And these sanctions should really be declared as crimes against humanity. They're nothing less.
All right, gentlemen, let's leave it there. Allow me to thank my guests, Mr. Isaac Bijo, joining us from the British capital, London. He's a Latin America expert. Also thanks to Mr. Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, speaking to us from San Francisco. Also a special thanks to you all for staying with us on Debate. It's goodbye. Until next time.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. And they are those who, if we give them authority in the land, establish prayer and give zakah and enjoin what is right and forbid what is wrong. And to Allah belongs the outcome of all matters.
So, brothers and sisters, we were into the 41st verse of the chapter. الَّذِينَ إِن مَكَّنَّاهُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ أَقَامُوا الصَّلَاةَ وَآتَوُوا الزَّكَاةَ. Those who, if we establish them in the land, perform prayer and pay the alms. وَأَمَرُوا بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَنَهَوْا عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. And they enjoin good and forbid evil. وَلِلَّهِ عَاقِبَةُ الْأُمُورِ. And unto Allah belongs the end of all affairs. So, dear listeners, we were previously talking about these two fundamental elements and somehow the elements that play a pivotal role in the society and community of the Muslims, which are, as the verse suggests, أَمَرُوا بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَنَهَوْا عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. So, we talked about some of the aspects of enjoining good and forbidding evil, and in this program, we'll try to cover another aspect of the issue. A rather important question regarding enjoining good and forbidding evil is that the interference of all people in the social affairs and somehow controlling the deeds of each other presumably could cause some disorders, could cause some confusions, and will make up some conflicts in the society. And considering this, we would see that it is the opposite of division of the duties and responsibilities in the society, since we have said that in the society everybody has got his or her affairs to do, and the responsibilities and the duties are completely divided. But how is it? Does enjoining right produce anarchy in the society? In answer to this problem, we say that through former discussions, this fact was made clear, that the process of enjoining right and forbidding wrong has two stages. The first stage, which has a rather general aspect, consists of a limited scope of action. It is not more than beyond admonition, advice, criticism, and the like. Admittedly, in a lively society, all the members must have at least this level of responsibility against the corruptions. The second stage, however, which is peculiar to a particular group and is counted among the authorities of the Islamic government, has a very vast scope of power. So, in the circumstances, it might necessitate some violence in action, even retaliation and execution of punishments, and this group has the authority of action under the view of Islamic judge and the responsible persons of the Islamic government.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insight into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Regarding the different stages of enjoining right and forbidding wrong and their limits and rules, not only there will not appear any anarchy in the society, but also the society will change from a dead and listless state into a very lively one. And by considering the traditions that were read to you in the previous programs, the narrations and traditions, considering the dangers and even sequels that may appear in the society, by forgetting these two important and pivotal duties of the members of the society, we would understand that we have to come to a solution for this answer. And of course, by noting the point that there is no absolute freedom in the society, because it's not possible for everyone to do everything he or she wants in the society, since it is called a society and community, which means we have to get along with each other by dividing the responsibilities and the duties that exist in the society. Now, at this point, in a rather small society and community, consider someone is not giving enough attention and is not focused on his or her responsibilities. What would you do in a rather small office where everyone's responsibilities are exactly mentioned and divided? Of course, the others have the right and consider the right for each other. A little bit of advice, criticism, and the like. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program as well. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters.
As thousands of people continue to die each and every day in the EU from COVID-19, a great deal of focus is on the issue of vaccines. The subject has just been debated by EU lawmakers.
Le campagne vaccinali sono
Inoculation campaigns began in the UK, the US, Russia and China. The European Union, what was it doing? It's been behind schedule again, waiting for some sort of green light from the European Medicines Agency. Same thing with managing the pandemic. The EU worked very badly. Nations had to go it alone.
We are told that the European Medicines Agency, which authorizes vaccines on behalf of the 27-nation EU, will give the go-ahead next week for use of the Pfizer-BioNTech jab. The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has tweeted that vaccination will start across the EU on December 27th, 28th and 29th. However, there is concern that nations are not prepared. Apparently, many EU countries have not yet submitted their vaccination plans to the Commission. EU authorities insist the process cannot be rushed.
Safety of vaccines.
We have been speaking to citizens.
We have to take care of getting this herd immunity through the vaccine. So it is key for our Western states to get there now, given that we're almost in the third wave, I think.
I just think that I will not get the vaccines for myself too early. I just want to wait a little bit to see if there are the secondary effects, bad effects on people.
Lawmakers are expressing outrage that the European Commission is resisting calls to share the formula of proven vaccines with developing nations on the basis that it would stifle investment into vaccine research.
I urge the Commission to rethink their position and to show the world that saving lives is more important than saving an outdated model of intellectual property rights. Access to medicine for all is a human right.
On the economic front, all sides agree that developing a successful vaccine strategy is crucial to preventing the EU from being rendered completely bankrupt. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
House of Kabul is a small but cozy coffee shop in downtown Tehran. As its name suggests, it's owned and operated by Afghan migrants. The cafe hosted reporters along with officials from the Iranian High Council for Human Rights for a friendly gathering to mark the International Migrants Day. It was a chance to both have a cup of tasty Afghan tea called Ghaymak and talk about the issues facing Afghan refugees in Iran.
I came with my family to Iran 13 years ago and started hospitality management here. I didn't face serious problems during my study in Iran, but now that I want to start a business, I have to go through a complicated process to acquire the needed licenses.
This was also the case for the owner of the House of Kabul Cafe, who moved to Iran 35 years ago and studied fine arts, and then ran this cafe as a family business. His son, Ali Akbar, who works as a barista here, says it was not an easy job to launch this coffee shop.
It took my father several years to get the license to run this cafe. It was because none of our family members have related degrees. But I'm so happy that we finally launched it, and we have many customers who enjoy our Afghan traditional drinks and foods.
More than 3 million Afghans live in Iran. A Around 1 million of them are refugees who have fled the ongoing conflict driven by terrorism and the presence of foreign troops in their country. Together with some 3,000 Iraqi refugees, they made Iran the 8th largest refugee hosting country in the world in 2019. The head of Iran's High Council for Human Rights did not ignore the issues migrants face in Iran and said he was here to listen to their concerns.
A significant portion of the Afghan refugees in Iran have entered the country illegally, and this creates some problems, especially with regards to their children's education. But during the past years and following a decree issued by our leader, all Afghan immigrants have access to free education. Today, our Afghan brothers and sisters in Iran are active in a variety of fields, and today, I had the chance to speak to some of their elites and listen to their concerns.
Based on the United Nations 2019 estimates, there are around 272 million migrants in the world. That's 3.5% of the global population. Each year on December 18th, the International Migrants Day is marked to highlight the contributions made by the migrant communities and to address the challenges they face. This year, the occasion focuses on the issue of social cohesion as one of the major concerns of each migrant.
Afghan migrants here say dignity and respect are the main things each migrant needs to integrate into a new society. This gains even more significance when they try to restart their lives in a place other than their home country, where they seek to build new lives away from conflict and disaster. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A new report says at least 40 European Parliament lawmakers from 14 member states signed a petition demanding that products from Israeli settlements be banned by the bloc. According to Palestine Embassy in Brussels, the petition calls for the application of European law and World Trade Organization law to prevent Israeli settlements' products from entering into the EU's markets. BDS, anti-Israel movement promoting boycotts, divestments, and sanctions against Israel, praised the move and hoped for further measures against the occupying regime.
It's an important move in the right direction. We have repeatedly demanded the European Parliament to ban goods from Israeli settlements because of crimes committed by the Israeli regime.
Many European Union nations decided to only label imported Israeli products that are produced in settlements in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and in the Golan Heights. Palestinian experts say barring goods produced in illegal settlements from entering into the EU markets will serve as a heavy blow to Israel, mainly because settlement goods are exported directly to European markets.
This reflects the European public opinion's main stance on the Palestinian cause. The petition is now going through its legal stages in the European Parliament. We hope it could be approved as a law in the future.
The cutting of Israeli products around the world has been growing rapidly in recent years and caused heavy losses to Israeli companies. Thousands of volunteers, trade unions, NGOs, academic and business societies, as well as cultural figures worldwide, have joined the boycott campaign to help promote the Palestinian cause. Most European countries don't deal with settlement products in the same way as Israeli products. They don't label them as being produced in Israel. But the most important for the Palestinians would be when the EU prohibits import and sale of goods, services, and natural resources originating from illegal Israeli settlements. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The Afghan Taliban delegation is in Pakistan to discuss the peace efforts. The delegation is headed by Mullah Brother, the head of Taliban's political office in Doha. The visit comes after Taliban and Afghan government took a 20-day break in their talks taking place in Doha. After months of negotiations, the two sides recently agreed on the rules of engagement. But there is no progress on the comprehensive ceasefire as Taliban have linked the truce with peace deal. But the Pakistan's foreign minister, who also met the Taliban leaders, said Taliban have shown their readiness to seek an end to the war. Afghan Taliban and the U.S. signed a landmark deal in February this year. The deal outlines a roadmap for the U.S. troops withdrawal from Afghanistan. In return, Taliban agreed not to allow Afghan soil to be used again by terrorist groups. Given Pakistan's historic ties with the Taliban, the U.S. and Afghan government expect Islamabad to ensure that the Taliban live up to their commitment. At the moment, all eyes are on the incoming US president as to whether he will follow the same policy on Afghanistan or take a different course.
On paper, there seems no change in the policy of US President-elect Joe Biden with regard to Afghanistan. But he may not hasten the troops withdrawal as sought by President Trump. This means the situation in Afghanistan will remain uncertain, at least in the foreseeable future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
In recent years, the U.S. Federal Reserve has reported multiple times that 40% of Americans don't have the cash to cover just a $400 emergency. Then COVID hit. The lack of savings is now almost twice as bad. A recent poll by the Highland Consultancy reveals that a stunning 82% of Americans now don't have the savings for a $500 emergency. It's a shocking reminder that the wealth in the richest nation in the world is distributed in a shockingly unequal fashion. For the average American household, $500 is equal to half a month's housing costs, 3 weeks of transportation, 2 weeks of childcare for one child, and less than a month of food.
If human needs are met, then people can put money away for emergencies. But when you're living where you can barely feed yourself, and where you can barely meet your housing needs, how can you possibly put money away?
In the decentralized United States, uneven, often draconian lockdowns are entering their ninth month, but there hasn't been any government help since a federal package in March. The result is a bevy of simply atrocious data, which reveals the financial suffering of the average American. 63% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck since the pandemic began. Public sector wages recently had their biggest monthly drop ever. New weekly jobless claims were greater than the worst week of the Great Recession for the 39th straight week. 800 small businesses have closed every day nationwide since April. Clearly, America's Main Street was already teetering on the edge prior to Corona.
We've got a society that's structured towards not meeting basic needs. That's important to everybody in the economy, that it have a sound foundation. And if you have people who are desperate on your foundation, the economy is always in danger of collapsing.
Corona deaths keep rising, the economy keeps plummeting, except for rich assets like stocks. And it's still not certain who won the presidential election. The U.S. is in the middle of its worst crisis since the 1930s, but it might be even worse than that. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said his country will no longer be affected dramatically by U.S. sanctions. He also accused the U.S. of imposing sanctions on Turkey to prevent it from becoming independent and developing its own defense sector. Erdogan's comments came after U.S. imposed sanctions on Turkey's defense industries and its chief.
This decision is a blatant assault on our nation's sovereign rights. This has been imposed for the first time against us, a NATO member. What kind of an alliance is this? Now we will work twice as hard to make our defense industry fully independent.
Turkey has always criticized the U.S. for its unilateral actions against other countries in the region, such as Iran.
This is not the first time that the U.S. imposes unnecessary sanctions on other countries. The sanctions come as a punitive act against any country trying to become independent. But I think that Turkey will overcome the sanctions.
Washington had already punished Ankara in July by barring it from developing parts for and acquiring America's next-generation F-35 fighter jets. Earlier, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif condemned what he called U.S. addiction to sanctions and contempt for international law. The sanctions cut off Turkey's top defense procurement agency from U.S. financial institutions, military hardware, and technology. Ties between the two NATO allies, Turkey and the U.S., were strained last year due to Ankara's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia. However, Turkey says it had to resort to Moscow to meet its needs after its own allies stopped responding to its demands. Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has stressed that the Islamic Republic will certainly take revenge for the U.S. assassination of the country's top general, Qasem Soleimani. Ayatollah Khamenei said Soleimani, who was killed in a U.S. drone strike in Iraq in January, has turned into a national hero for Iranians as well as Muslims elsewhere in the world. The leader said million-strong funerals that were held for the general served as a severe slap in the face of the Americans. He added that the expulsion of the U.S. troops from the region will be a more severe blow to the United States. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader called on officials to explore ways to remove sanctions, but stressed that efforts should be focused on neutralizing the sanctions first. Ayatollah Khamenei cautioned against trusting the enemies and warned that America's hostilities towards Iran will not end even after President Donald Trump leaves office. The leader also lashed out at the European signatories to the Iran nuclear deal, saying they have showed utmost breach of commitments and hypocrisy. Also, President Hassan Rouhani said Iran is not overexcited that Joe Biden will replace Donald Trump in a matter of weeks.
Some people say you are rejoiced at the election of Mr. Biden. No, we are not, but we are very happy that Trump is leaving, a man who committed so many crimes, who was a murderer, a terrorist, a man who even is preventing us from buying coronavirus vaccines. This man has absolutely no morals. Yes, we are very happy that this tyrant, the one who was not committed to anything, is ousted.
Iranian officials have time and time again stressed that it does not matter who takes the helm at the White House as long as U.S. hostile policies towards Iran remain in place. Still, all eyes are now on the next U.S. administration to find out whether it will toe the line of its predecessors or reverse the course.
The Gaza Strip is witnessing a sharp increase in coronavirus infections, with thousands of cases being discovered on a daily basis. The Gaza Strip has logged more than 30,000 COVID-19 infections, mostly since late August. Hospitals in the blockaded enclave are running short on intensive care units to treat coronavirus patients. Experts say the Israeli blockade imposed on Gaza is the main reason why tackling the deadly pandemic is particularly difficult.
The blockade had devastated the Gaza Strip even before the coronavirus pandemic. Now our health sector suffers from acute shortage of medicines and hospital supplies. The health sector is falling apart, and the world must immediately intervene and help the Gaza Strip fight the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus is fast spreading in the tiny enclave, and people fear the worst because of the high population density.
The health sector has been under pressure because of the blockade, and the coronavirus pandemic has only made things even worse. Over 200 people in Gaza have already died because of coronavirus.
The Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment, despite the alarming number of coronavirus infections.
We demand an immediate end to Israeli violations that amount to war crimes. We also hold Israel accountable for its illegal actions. Medicines and hospital supplies must be allowed to enter Gaza to help fight this deadly virus. The main obstacle to fight the coronavirus pandemic in Gaza is the Israeli blockade.
The United Nations has warned that the enclave's health system could collapse if the number of cases continues to rise.
Gaza's health system has been battered by the Israeli blockade and three wars since 2007. The dire situation has worsened amid the coronavirus pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
An exhibition called Beyond the Columns of Media opened at the Museum of Classical Art based in Rome's La Sapienza University. the initiative, sponsored by the Italian ambassador to Tehran, Giuseppe Terrone, is the result of collaboration between the Italian Archaeological Mission in Iran and the Ministry of Cultural Heritage, Tourism and Handicrafts of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran's ambassador Hamid Bayat and La Sapienza University rector Antonella Polimeni were among the attendees of the event.
We decided to focus on the Kermanshah province from two points of view. One is that of sustainable tourism, and the other one, the study of cultural heritage. What we did here is travel the road that goes from Kasr Shirin to Kangavar and crosses ancient Media.
The exhibit features 16 panels put together by Italian students, representing an ideal journey through the great ancient trade route and communication network known as the Silk Road.
It's very important because all these informations help us to understand better how the Sasanian period worked, how the region were connected.
Panels portrayed the historical region of the Media between the Mesopotamian plain and the Iranian plateau. The exhibition itinerary follows a diachronic development that starts from the Iron Age through the dynasties of the Achaemenids, Arsacids, and Sassanids.
Italy and Iran have long-standing connections that go back in history and have resulted in a deep understanding between the two countries. The cultural and political relations date back to the time of the Roman and Persian empires and are marked by important affinities.
This project represents the full potential of collaboration between Italy's and Iran's cultural institutions. Its implementation makes us once again rediscover long-established Italian-Iranian connections.
Due to the COVID pandemic, most academic activities have been carried out remotely via video conference. All attendees wished for a prompt return to pre-COVID ways of working. Max Civili, Rome.
Britain woke up to more worrying news this December morning. 1,800, 19,000 fewer workers out of paid employment in November than at the start of the health crisis, meaning coronavirus continues to weigh heavily on the UK labour market.
Is this the direct impact of the pandemic on the UK's labour market?
The problem started before the coronavirus, and the measures being taken are only glossing over the realities. The system is fundamentally flawed. Rich-poor division has got more extreme. The type of jobs coming in are not the old secure, well-paid jobs. They're the insecure, low-paid, temporary jobs.
Released by the Office for National Statistics, the report also says there has been a record rise in redundancies in the 3 months to October, 370,000 of them. Worst hit, those in the hospitality sector, teetering during the pandemic. The government says its measures are necessary for beating the virus.
We've put a lot of work in over the past month. There's been enormous sacrifice on everyone's part, and we want to make sure that we continue suppressing the virus. The good news is that we've made improvements, whether it's in mass testing or early promising news on vaccines.
While the prospect of a functioning vaccine has injected some optimism into people's lives, experts say the next few months are likely to remain very challenging.
Do you think more people are going to be out of work in the coming months?
Yes. They will falsify the figures, and they do that by they've done this for years and years, and they massage out of the figures people who are really unemployed.
Add to the mix the immediate impact of a no-deal Brexit, the UK leaving the European Union without a trade deal at the end of this month.
There's also the fact that the unemployment figures don't tell the whole story. There's always a lag in the data. And the government's job retention scheme, also known as the furlough scheme, is propping up the labor market. For now.
In November, the UK Chancellor warned the number of unemployed people in the country was expected to surge to 2.6 million by the middle of next year. And that may be a conservative figure. The fact is that COVID-19 is here to stay, and it'll be months, if not longer, for everyone to be vaccinated. the unforgiving equation is that the tighter the measures to protect lives, the more devastating the impact on livelihoods. Saeed Pariza, London.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome once again to another program of For a Better Life. And we were talking about arrogance. And we talked about the reasons why people feel this negative emotion within themselves. One of the reasons where property, when you have wealth, you suddenly see that you become arrogant towards others who do not have the same wealth. And it needs practice. We need to practice to demolish this feeling of arrogance within ourselves. And we also mentioned the second reason. The second reason, except property, was knowledge. Knowledge that one obtains from university, from experience, from the Islamic seminaries. It inflicts all of us. It embraces all of us who are seeking knowledge, who are in the pursuit of knowledge. And knowledge is one of the reasons that we can get arrogance within us. Your arrogance can grow within us because of knowledge. And that kind of arrogance, which comes from knowledge, is actually worse than property. When one thinks that he is more important because of his knowledge, he looks down on others and considers himself to be, as the narration says, the scholars are the inheritors of the prophets. So me sitting here talking to you, dear brothers and sisters, who have studied in the Islamic seminaries of Qom, if I feel that I am the inheritor of the knowledge of the prophets, and I feel this arrogance coming within me, then this is a very dangerous path. It is dangerous when I think that others must obey me due to my knowledge. This danger is more evident for religious students than others, because in others, arrogance shows itself in a monetary situation. But with religious students or the students of the Islamic seminaries, arrogance shows itself in position, not in monetary situations, but in position. His nafs, the carnal soul that we always talk about, his nafs wants to be in a higher position. He says, I am more knowledgeable than him or her. I have studied more than he or she has. I have this degree. Position is in relation to faith and actions. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would only look upon your faith and your action. Those two combined. The knowledge that is important is the knowledge of Allah and the last day. It is a light found in one's heart that humbles him. But what if you have that knowledge? And you just have that knowledge. You can come with thousands of reasons for why you believe in the last day, why you believe in the existence of Allah. But in your life, you don't practice it. You have arrogance within you. No matter how much knowledge